you like this episode, please subscribe, share with others, rate and review so we can continue to bring you great programming.
This is The Thing About Cars, a podcast for car enthusiasts and the people who love them.
Balls.
All right, here we go. So where were we? We were talking about design sensibilities and stuff before then. But Bob, I know you get pestered with questions about the Miata all the time.
That's fine.
What are you doing these days and what's on your desk these days?
I'll tell you a story. When I first started to work at Geely, I was asked by a very good person in the company who has vision, which is unusual, anybody at the top of a car company. And he said, Bob, tell me, is there anything you will not do for Geely? I said, yes. So there's two things. What are they? I said, I will not kill a man. And I said, and I will not design a front engine, rear drive, two-seat sports car. And here's the guy, head of the company, laughing his head off at it because he knew what I meant. And I haven't.
Right.
And I haven't. I deliberately stay away from stuff like that. Could a company like Geely use a sports car? Perhaps. But the other thing that's happened is the world has changed radically.
Yeah.
Okay, and I don't think people fully understand that. I am, most people don't believe this, I'm a big fan of EVs. I mean, how could you not be a fan of a vehicle that has peak torque at 1 RPM?
Yeah, I know. It's crazy.
Come on, right? Yeah. And where it's so easy to make something four-wheel drive by just putting two bloody motors in it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so but then, Ed, that's just me. So what on earth do I know? What I started out to do when I joined the company, what I'm doing now is a little bit different. And that's because the situation changed. Originally, I was working very heavily on approach to the U.S. market. And we had an idea and a plan penciled in and a way to do it, which quite frankly was really neat and really different. Okay. And we had done a study. One of the guys in charge of Geely International in those days, a guy named Zhang Ling, was just about raised in Detroit. And he worked at Ford and then a long time at Chrysler. And originally they sent him to China and he came back and worked in the States. He knew the US quite well. And he was a fine supporter of doing anything that had potential that was different. Not different for the sake of being different, but we had potential. But it was a kind of torpedoed when the number 40, was it 47, set down at 1600, and that put the kibosh on that. And there was this misguided belief that I was working out of the design center, working with design, but also working on the strategy group and product planning. And there was this thought that, well, if we're not going to sell cars in the States now, we should close down the design center. Well, that's nonsensical. Design centers, the purpose of design center is to collect ideas, okay, concepts, new things. And out here is a good place because there's an enormous car stuff that starts here. I'm not going to say it's where it all comes from, but there's a huge amount of very influential movements here, some small, some large, but in the end, they help steer the market. The other thing is that the Japanese had design centers here before they were building cars, long before, and when they were still selling more overseas. The secret they had in some cases was Mazda didn't do it much, but Toyota would do it backdoor with things to say, well, it was designed in California. And a lot of people around the world really like that. There's a big deal when you buy an iPhone in China, they make a big deal that it was designed in California. And it helps the sales. So, you know, it's a logical thing to do. The other thing is you can hire people you never get to hire in China.
Right.
So there's a lot of benefit to it. So we're here for that first, foremost, and always. Whenever we come to the States, we'll do it. I would like to think we'll do it with products that people aren't expecting.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'm excited.
Well, I am too. I just don't know when it's going to happen. But we have a nice portfolio of products ready for whenever it does take place.
You said just a moment ago that it was rare to meet the head of a car company with vision, and I know that's sort of tongue in cheek, but it reminds me of something that we've said here on The Thing About Cars before, which is we've got a small amount of frustration with the number of concept cars that are flashed around in various shows around the world that never make it to production. And I was kind of wondering if you could shed some light on that. Why would a car company go through all the trouble of creating a concept car that they don't intend to produce?
Depends on the company. Okay. They all kind of, for lack of a better term, they kind of approach it differently. Some companies, the concept cars are pilot build bodies of a new model that's coming out that has a $48,000 paint job and $28,000 wheels on it. Mm-hmm. But it's basically a facelifted version of the production car. They do that as teasers a lot. Okay. They also will do it at times to feel the public out. There might be a design direction that's extremely controversial within the company on a product that's a number of years out. So they do a concept car that might not be in the same segment or the same size to see what feedback they get on their grill that looks like a sole of an Adidas sports shoe, for example. Okay. And maybe the Adidas guy say, oh God, I want that. Okay. But the guy wearing Nike says, that sucks. Okay. So that's a part of this. Okay. The other thing that happens, and I've seen this happen at a lot of companies, management up the food chain changes. And a lot of times they don't want to promote what somebody else has done.
Mm.
That's the way it, and the management could be in design, it could be at marketing, it could be CEO, could be engineering, whatever. There's a lot of personalities in the car business. And those personalities are I think personally personalities pretty good, huh? Are a bit of a double-edged sword, because if you do car design by committee, you're doomed. Okay.
Yeah.
And this is the argument I have against clinics. And one of the things I strongly dislike about clinics is you learn what somebody wants today on a car that you might not be able to get on the market for 4 years. What does that tell you? Gosh, this thing would have, and you do a clinic, and I've seen this happen. Car rates right through the roof. And the customer doesn't know what's coming out in 6 months or a year. So even if you do the clinic late in the process, it tells you what you don't need to know. Gosh, this car is doing great. And then it comes out and it tanks. Well, why is that? The problem in situations like that is the guys that push for this stuff are usually for marketing. The biggest problem I have against marketing, most marketing people are not marketing people. They're salespeople.
You know, they're salespeople.
You know, yeah. The difference? You know the difference between a salesperson and a marketing person?
What?
A salesperson will sell you what you want. Marketing person will sell you something you don't want or need.
Right.
And there aren't enough of them. Okay. I hate to put it that way, but there aren't enough, because I used to joke. Well, actually, when we did not the Miata, but another car, we had the guy who was in charge of marketing, Dwayne Bowen. We said, hey, we want to show you this project and you'll be the first person outside design to see it. And he said, I don't want to see it, Bob. I said, how come? He says, well, what kind of segment of car? I told him, says, well, I've got stuff. It's going to be on runout. I don't want to see it, because no matter how good it is, I'll say it's no good, because I got to worry about selling the runout car. So he says, if you guys like it, go ahead with it. As he understood, I've come across people in every company I've worked with one exception, and I won't say who it is, but it wasn't Mazda. I've come across people at some point or other whose idea of the future was the last 30 days sales figures. Now, is that dangerous or what?
That seems very limited to me.
You're being polite.
Yeah, I am being polite. Yeah.
And it's sad but true. Okay. And that's the reason we have this orgy of SUVs.
Yes.
Nobody has given any thought to the fact. Here's my complaint about SUVs. Ready?
Ready.
Pony cars. On the 12th of April, 1964, Ford completely changed the North American automotive scene when they launched the Mustang. Okay. By the end of 67, every one of the big three plus Nash, American Motors, had a pony car. And some of them were really good. And some of my, I love it. In those days, I was like, oh yeah, pony car. And I loved 67 and 68 Firebird. Okay. Particularly because you could get a Sprint overhead cam six in it, a performance six. Ooh, what's wrong with that?
Right.
I love the 1970 Barracuda, the first car I ever bought new. Interesting story on that.
Yep.
And I thought they were great. But when you go now, Let's jump to 1975. Mm-hmm. Where are they? What's left? Nothing.
Right.
And the reason was, and this is the thing manufacturers don't look at, and that's psychographics. Psychographics is about the psychological profile of your buyers. There's basically four types, A, B, C's, and D's. A's and B's are like opinion leaders. C's and D's are followers. This is the volume in the C and D. And when the A's and B's find something they like and jump into it, they will have an impact on everybody else. With pony cars, it got to the point that all the opinion leaders saw everybody driving a pony car. And one of the problems, because you could buy a Mustang or something for $2,500 when it came out. And that was, when that takes place, they go looking for something else. And my suspicion is when the SUV market tanks, it will tank a lot more rapidly than anybody expects, given how big it is. Because once these people who are the followers see the others in something new that comes up that maybe we haven't even seen yet, okay, that will make a huge difference in the way the market goes. And if you think about it, we see a little bit of that with MPVs. Remember, T115 came out, Chrysler did the MPV, really took out, everybody had them. How many MPVs can you buy now?
Yeah.
You hear the noise of a tumbleweed blowing down an empty street, right?
Yep.
And that's because it was the same thing. You had a group that was important in moving the dynamic who then suddenly decided SUVs. And there'll be something coming along. And I add this particularly because of electrification. And the reason is electrification allows you to radically change the proportion of an automobile. So they can come up with stuff that we can't even conceive of right now. In fact, I'm sure a few companies are already working on stuff like that.
I just want them to bring back that rear-facing seat in the station wagon.
You want a captain's chair that in the station wagon that rotates?
No. Here's what you can do.
No, a bench seat.
It can come back. Okay. Mm-hmm. Just pick up a copy of Hemmings Motor News. Okay, and see what you can find in the range of like 1957 or 58 DeSotos. They were great wagons, those Suburbans. I tell you, and they had the rearward-facing seat, so the kids could see doom coming as they get rear-ended.
Build character. It's good for the children.
Well, Bob, I have two more questions for you, but I want to make sure Ben gets a chance to ask a question. Ben, do you have anything for Bob before I wrap?
Not right this second. I've just been enjoying the whole flow of it. So when I'm having that much fun, I have trouble thinking of questions.
Right. I wrote down one of my questions and now I can't think of the other one.
By the way, anyway. I love the Japanese mini shop in your background.
Thank you. Yes, that was. I need to get screens to the rest of my colleagues here so they can put something up if they want. But I was just looking for no royalty or no copyright images that would work for a good background. But
I was reading the sign. I didn't notice on the license plate initially.
Yeah. So I saw a meme the other day. And someone said, it was a mechanics meme who they'd opened the hood of a mini because the engine compartment says, screw you. There's no room to do anything in there.
No. Yes, there is. There's room to remove the engine to work on it.
Point.
That's right. That's the only way to get in there to do anything is just to remove the engine. I opened up the first mini that came to the American market when they rebooted it here in America, and there was no room to get my hand between the radiator and the engine block.
That's why the old British ones are great, because even though they're a foot smaller in every dimension than the BMW ones, you can get to stuff in them.
Mm-hmm.
I had one when I was in Germany. The block was, of course it was a very small displacement engine, but still, there was room in there.
Yep. Yep.
And there is enough room to shoehorn a Honda VTEC into it too. I've seen it done.
Misty. You've seen it done. Okay, yeah, sure, Ben.
Misty, do you have any questions for Bob before I wrap with my two questions?
Nope, just reiterating my open invitation to come cruise the Autobahn in the latest version of your godchild.
Autobahn driving, though, is a waste of time for that. It wasn't made for that. There's not enough corners. Not enough corners on Autobahn.
Yeah, Autobahns are boring.
Good point. There's one time that there's a roundabout between my house and the freeway that I like to straighten out, and that's when my son screams like a girl. Just saying.
My last trivia question before my last two questions is, the word Miata means prize or reward in what language, Misty? Is it Italian? Is it Old High German? Is it Japanese? Or is it Russian, pre-revolution Russian?
I'm going with Japanese. It's Italian-esque, but not quite.
Ben, that is a
very good guess.
Ben, what do you think?
I think Bob just gave it away there.
Well, let's confirm that. Ben, what do you think?
I don't know. It doesn't sound right for any of them into my brain.
Well, Deutsche.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Deutsche, yeah, natürlich.
It is Old High German.
I speak Dutch. I don't speak German anymore. You know, yeah. I mean, I spoke German for like 2 years when I had it in high school, and then I learned Dutch, and now I'm just like, Bitterballer?
After we're done recording, I'll tell you the rather impolite thing that a Rodent Track letter to the editor said about it.
All right, we'll have to get back on that. Bob, my last serious question for you for today is, what do you think about EV technology and the future of EV technology here? I mean, whenever we've talked about EVs on the show, we always come down to two basic questions, and it always has something to do with, will battery technology improve good enough? I mean, you know, well enough, and will the infrastructure for recharging expand and also be improved in this country to make EVs more feasible for everybody? And what do you think about that?
The battery technology, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Okay, there's so many manufacturers working on it, and the potential payoff is so great beyond automobiles. Okay, I was fascinated. So my evil twin brother, who retired from GM recently, did a lot of work with EVs and conceptual stuff. And he told me something that was kind of funny. He said, when you talk to people in focus groups and ask them about EVs, they want their EV range around 400 miles. If you talk to these people in different focus groups, held in different locations with different people asking the questions, and you talk about regular cars, and they're happy with 260-mile range in their regular car. Isn't that interesting?
That is interesting.
And I think to a huge degree, it's because of charging time.
Yeah.
And just as much as range, charging time is a factor. No doubt about that. As for infrastructure, the primary infrastructure is potentially quite good, especially if you're a homeowner, because you can put something in the garage and plug in overnight. That's fine. It's when you go out with a car and such.
Yeah.
And I think mm-hmm. what we may find is in countries such as the United States, Australia, to a degree the UK and such, the two-car family will be the lifesaver here. Because you might have the EV and you have a plug-in hybrid, and you use them as needed. So you may find that somebody with a work commute will drive the EV, and the plug-in hybrid has the benefit of being used in two areas. Be used for that when needed, or it can be used for the long drive. And in time, obviously, if they expect this to work, they'll have to improve the infrastructure. The concern I have beyond the primary infrastructure is, where are you going to generate the electricity?
Yeah.
Because that's another aspect that if the demand goes real high, how are you going to continue to do it? Also, the other, lack of a better term, structural issues. Will oil companies evaporate overnight? No, because there'll be a big stock of cars. But you might find some oil companies, if they get into fast charging, would set up fast charging centers. You never tell. It's a possibility.
It's a possibility.
It's a way they can,
yeah.
They can keep their revenue going.
Right. If they're smart, they'll do it.
Yeah. And then the other one, of course, is when you talk about this whole infrastructure issue is, who pays for what? Mm-hmm. Okay. Obviously, you have a home and you can put a charger there. That's fine. You get to pay for it, mm-hmm. and it'll pay itself off real quick. But it's going to take a while for it to be sorted out, the technology as well. I would hate to be with a company that has settled on a single battery technology, though, because I think what we'll see is in this move to the future, there'll be some technologies that'll be developed and go fine, and there'll be some that don't go anywhere.
Yep.
So you have to choose correctly, or choose so that your car has versatility.
Yeah,
because you'd never sell a car you can only fill up at a Sinclair station, would you?
Right,
right.
Exactly. Yeah, I think the biggest question, you know, and I've heard this a lot from people that are pushing back quote unquote, against the EVs. You know, you still have to charge them, and that takes a coal. And I'm like, no, it doesn't. Because like in the Netherlands, our rail system, our train system is entirely wind powered.
Yeah, the brilliant thing about electricity is you have so many options for how to source it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You know,
I think there should be fusion reactors everywhere.
That'd be cool.
That would be
cool. Okay. I really just want to walk 200 meters to the river and pull out three-eyed fish. That'd be great.
Cool. Misty, fusion, much safer than fission.
Well, you know, but
at least until the shielding fails.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
See, that's what I'm talking about, you know. No, but
the point is, here in California, okay, you haven't been able to burn coal here for 30 years.
Yeah.
There's no coal-generated electricity. And the electric, the gas is being wound down. We're doing much more with wind. California, like Australia, is a potential gold mine for solar. Each of us have miles and miles with a lot of sun.
Yep.
The options for infrastructure are highly regional. And this of course makes it a little tricky if you're a central government trying to dictate it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, but it's like, I mean, like I look around here in the Netherlands and I see a lot more solar. I mean, like last year they put solar panels on our house. We rent our house and the owners put solar panels. My electricity bill literally dropped in half.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, okay, admittedly, I don't have air conditioning and all I have is electricity and I have some natural gas for like literally my stove and my hot water heater. Our electricity bill went from 120 euros a month to 60.
Yep.
And it's one of amazing the new parking garages.
Yeah, it's. I'm sorry, Misty, go ahead.
I was going to say one of the new parking garages that they built down in the middle of town, it has like, it looks like shutters, but all of those shutters are solar panels, like on all four sides.
Mm-hmm.
So that can feasibly power that whole shopping center and that whole area of, you know, restaurants and the library, and there's housing there and all that. So, I mean, if we can do it and we're a country the size of a postage stamp, I mean, we're smaller than Rhode Island. So
to Bob's point, you know, I like the idea that solar energy gives more regional freedom. And I think that that's huge to me, at least, to see all these people out there who are opposing solar or the conversion to solar are also the folks who seem to crave freedom. And I just don't understand why they're not matching up on that point. But anyway, Bob, my last question before we wrap the episode, and I keep saying it's the last question, but we wrap the episodes with four questions for our guests.
This is like, you know, talking to my good friend, the lieutenant, the LAPD homicide division with the Peugeot. One more thing.
Yeah.
My wife always sends me out with a pencil. Do you have a pencil, sir?
I'll take that as a compliment. So the last show related question, because we ask all of our guests the same questions at the end of our segments, which is, and I'm going to ask you these in a minute, what's your dream car? Where's your next road trip? And what's the most fascinating thing you've seen on the road? But before we get there, Ken, the thing about cars, that's me, Ben, Misty, and a couple other regulars who aren't here today. Can we sign up to be test drivers for anything that Geely produces?
You could, but we don't do any US test driving here for probably a long time because we're R&D. And design only out here.
Yeah,
but I'm sure.
US.
I'm sure you could sign up. I'm sure you could sign up for one of the outfits we work with that does sell cars here, Volvo.
Well, you know what really sucks.
There's a brick wall between us and Volvo. When Chairman Lee bought Volvo, he had a bunch of guys that said, "I'll go and run it." And his attitude is, you don't spend the money to buy a brand like that, have your guys take it over and maybe destroy the value of the brand.
Yeah.
So there's a wall between us on Volvo stuff. There's some cooperation, like the development of the XC40. The underbody on that was developed with a Geely company in Sweden. And that car is sold as an XC40, but underneath it's a Link 01.
Hmm.
Well, I believe Lotus is in the portfolio too. And what really sucks about that is until a few years ago, their US headquarters was like 5 minutes from my house.
Well, there you go.
They moved it to Detroit.
Right.
Well, the European headquarters are down the road in Amsterdam. Yeah. And I still didn't, I never did get an answer on my application there, but that's okay.
That's okay.
I'll live.
You live, you're closer to tacos now.
Yeah. And Dunkin' Donuts.
So, yeah, I just, you know, I had to ask Bob if there's a chance for me to be able to do some beta testing for anybody. I'm always happy to do that.
I'd love it if we could get, you know, Geely company cars, because you could find them easy in parking lots. Yeah. But instead we get Volvos.
Oh. All right. Wow. So in our last remaining 13 minutes of the show, our standard questions for all our guests are the three standard ones that I just read to you, and then one random, silly, frivolous question. The first question is, of course, what is your dream car?
It would be a very bizarre car. It'd be a kind of a street rod. Okay. The base of the car would be a 1939 Nash Lafayette two-door fastback. Okay. That underneath would have the driveline from an R37 GTR. Okay, driveline, not engine.
Right.
And the engine would be a E63 M3 engine.
This is an interesting mashup of influences here. Why this and not just say a stock GTO or something like that?
The 39 Nash to me is one of the coolest looking cars on earth. The Lafayette was the smallest, the short wheelbase, balance is neat. I just love it. It's got this wonderful wind split with a divided rear window that runs down the deck lid. It's got these astronomical, cool rectangular headlights that had no light at all, but which you could use the housings for a super LED system.
Yeah. Yeah.
The grill on it is just, it's an Art Deco magnificent piece of work. And I like the Nissan has done a good job with the underpinnings on the GTR.
Yep.
And of course, one of the other critical issues, and E36, I just love the way it sounds. It's a great engine. The other critical with it issue is you could easily find it in a parking lot. Okay.
Yeah. All right. So where's your next road trip going to be?
Karen, where's our next road trip? It's to Ralph's, right? Yeah, I think it's to Ralph's.
Okay.
We're in work from home. We're work from home mode. So last one we did, we went up to Monterey.
Ah, very cool.
Non race weekend.
Right. No.
We just went up for the sake of seeing our buddies and going to eat where we want to eat and all that other stuff.
I keep meaning to get to Monterey at some point. That's, you know, I believe that's Steinbeck's old stomping grounds, and I'm a huge Steinbeck fan. But yeah, that's anyway. All right. So question number three, what's the most fascinating thing you've seen on the road or in someone's garage?
Or in your own garage.
My own garage has a white V60 in it. This is a toughie. This is a real toughie. I did see an absolutely immaculate 64-65 Mustang GT convertible.
Ooh. Mm-hmm, nice.
In my favorite color, which was called Poppy Red. And I don't like red, but I love that color, complete with the white GT stripes. And it reminded me because a friend of mine, and when that car came out, a friend of mine's mom had one. And she hated automatics. She had a 4-speed manual in it. She didn't have the 271 horse hypo, but it had factory air conditioning, as factory as could be, being hung under the dash, but installed by the dealer. But she kept that car for about 10 years. Love to know where it is.
Yeah. All right. My very last question. There won't be another Columbo moment here. Bob, if you were arrested with no explanation, what would your friends and family assume you had done?
I suspect the automatic assumption they would make is I had just had oysters and I was trying to get home to my wife quickly.
That'll work.
That's
my guess. Beautiful. Okay. That is beautiful. Guess. Bob Hall, I thank you for being our guest on the thing about cars today. We are honored to be in your presence. And
I'm just some guy who is doing his job. Nothing special.
Okay? Oh, well, and I hope if you have time that maybe we can invite you back to the microphone sometime. I think that would be a fun thing for all of us.
Anytime. My time is yours. I have nowhere to go and all day to get there. So
And I just want to say thank you for letting me, you know, 100% fangirl. You know, like I said, I make no bones about, you know, about the love for my car. And
just leave the luggage rack off, okay? Come on. Luggage racks, the only car.
Since you asked.
Sorry, the only car it was supposed to have a luggage rack was Todd Stiles, 1960 through 1964 Chevrolet Corvette in Route 66.
Bingo.
Well, since you ask, I will discontinue my quest for a luggage rack and just go ahead and have the backup camera put in, you know, because that doesn't change the outside. But you know, she's definitely, you know, she's my inanimate best friend, and the amount of looks I get, especially when I'm, you know, zipping by, and I usually have either a Jefferson Airplane White Rabbit or Ram Jam Black Betty going at high volume with my lovely Bose sound system. Yeah, it attracts attention.
Best sound system in that car is the exhaust.
Yes, thank you.
Yes. Oh my God.
You don't really need radio. Don't you really need a radio in it?
Yeah, it's. I have to admit, there's something when that engine turns over and it goes zoom zoom, and I'm just my heart goes pitter patter, and I fall in love again.
When the first generation car was being done, Mr. Harai, who was the program manager, and you wouldn't have a father of the Miata. He is it, the only one, because without him, there wouldn't have been a damn car. Because he was the guy who had to put together. He asked us what it should sound like, and I sent him recordings I pulled off from episodes of The Avengers of Mrs. Peel's car, particularly when she would lift off the exhaust. And I think they did a damn good. He actually told him this is what the car has to sound like.
Yeah.
It's definitely a head turner, and it's definitely, you know, I've frequently said I don't mind if you make my MX-5 an EV. Just make sure it has an MP3 player in it so it still makes the zoom zoom sound. And I'll be perfectly happy.
MP3 technology would be gone by then, but there'll be something.
That's something else.
Or
that's
something. Right. You know, I just want it to make sound. Like MP10 to the fifth power or something. I just want it to continue to make that sound. That is such a huge part of the enjoyment factor.
MP88 would be the luckiest.
To our audience, we're going to fade out on this, I'm sure. But to our audience, thank you for being our in our Thing About Cars family today. We hope you and yours are enjoying the holidays and are staying warm and safe. We'll see you with another episode in about a week.
May I quote someone for a quote? Bye-bye.
Please do.
I'll quote Dan Matthews, head of the Highway Patrol. Leave blood at the Red Cross, not on the highway. See you next week.
Leave blood at the Red Cross, not at the highway. That may be the title of the show. I don't know. It'd be good. So, thanks again, Bob. We really appreciate it.
Are you still going to torment Dean sometime or not?
Oh, absolutely. You want to come back for that?
Of course I do.
I was about to say, we should have an episode.
Do I want to come back for it? Okay. Good grief.
Is the Pope Catholic?
he was supposed to join us today, and I was going to try to surprise everybody with your presence. But he unfortunately has a memorial to go to, and I'm sure he'll tell you about that if he wants to. But Dean and I, he wants to come back on and talk about SAE formula and SAE. I can't remember the other designation, but that's going to happen. I'll keep you posted so you can join us for that.
All right. Test his memory. Tell him you might have Atlas King on the show.
Atlas King. I'm writing this down.
Atlas King is a novel that my brother and I have been working on since 1980 something.
Oh, goodness. Did you ever finish it?
We're still working. It's about the world's most famous secret agent.
Oh,
nice.
Okay. It takes place after the Change War,
which
left the sole superpower left on Earth is Switzerland.
Uh-huh.
And the south coast of Switzerland extends down to the Mediterranean.
I can see that.
And Atlas King battles Keith.
Uh-huh.
And Keith is the most evil person in the world because he wants to destroy the world.
Yeah.
And only because he upset his parents when he didn't become a music teacher.
I love this. I would so read that or watch that.
I can send you a copy of it up to chapter 22.
Oh, I was going to say.
My brother got upset. The reason we stopped working on it for a period of time was I killed Atlas King at the end of one chapter.
Uh-oh.
Mm.
But I didn't really kill him. Jim forgot about certain aspects that he had already set up.
It's supernatural. Everybody dies at least once.
It was in a very trendy nightclub in a building. It's in New York, or Nouveau York, as it is known after the war.
Right.
In a building that was once known as the United Nations. It's now a beatnik club.
Yeah.
Okay, I need to read this. I was going to say,
yeah,
you need test readers for that. Please let me have a finished copy.
It's not even near finished, but I'll send you a copy and you can distribute.
That'll be awesome.
Any and all feedback.
Fantastic.
Okay, take it easy, guys.
Thanks, Bob.
All right.
As we used to say at Mazda,
less is more.
See you.
See you. Also,
take care, everybody. Bye-bye, you guys.
Thank you for listening. This has been The Thing About Cars. We'll see you on the road.